This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A wise man I think we all know once called space the final frontier. Over the years, our exploration of space has spurred inventions, information, and imaginations. Now we're looking to our nearest planetary neighbor to learn more about our own world.
We think Mars may have actually been very Earth-like in its early history. Obviously, something has happened. Something has changed on Mars.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to one of the world's leading experts on Mars about how studying the red planet is teaching us a little bit more about Earth. We'll also hear about NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory and how it's helping us explore beyond our own solar system. Then it's a quick trip back to Mars for an academic minute about what the planet's impact craters tell us about its atmosphere. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. If you want to learn just about anything about the planet Mars, Dr. Nadine Barlow should be your first call. Dr. Barlow is a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Northern Arizona University. She's recently turned her gaze back to planet Earth to see if we can learn something about our own climate from her study of Mars. I spoke to Dr. Barlow and asked how she got involved in this study. What sent her to Mars?
Oh, boy. I actually got interested in astronomy many, many, many years ago, and it was during the time period when we were first starting our exploration of Mars, our spacecraft exploration. And it was those pictures just really enthralled me because it was the first time we actually had seen Mars as a planet with geology. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. It's no longer just this little red point of light in the sky. We can actually tell something about its history. This was when I was a kid, and I continued to follow and keep track of what was going on. But once I got to college and I actually started doing research in graduate school, my advisor said, well, I've got this project related to impact craters on Mars and what they might tell us about the distribution of water and ice under the surface, and would you be interested in working on that? And I grabbed it, and I've been involved with Mars ever since.
Why is the search? We hear an awful lot about the search for liquid water or evidence of liquid water on Mars. Why is that important?
Well, first off, under the current climatic conditions, Mars cannot have liquid water on its surface. So it's a very thin atmosphere, it's a very cold environment, and so if you put liquid water on the surface, it's either going to immediately evaporate into the atmosphere or it's going to turn to ice. But yet we see a lot of geologic evidence and mineralogical evidence that there's actually large expanses of liquid water on the surface in the past. And in fact, we think Mars may have actually been very Earth-like in its early history. Obviously, something has happened. Something has changed on Mars. And so we'd like to know, what happened to Mars? Could something like that happen on Earth? Could we prevent it from happening here on the Earth? And then, of course, the other issue is that we have a very strong interest in actually sending humans to Mars and establishing colonies. So trying to figure out where the water might be hidden today is important for us to know what resources are actually available to the future colonies that we hope to establish on Mars.
Does this study help us possibly understand climate change here on Earth?
Yes, it does. We actually do see that there is natural climate change on Mars. As I mentioned, early Mars probably was much more Earth-like. But even in more recent times, i.e., millions of years as opposed to billions of years ago, we do see evidence that Mars goes through periods where you get a lot more snowfall occurring down to mid-latitudes, where today it's confined to the polar regions. So if we can look at Mars and also Venus on the other side of us, which has the extreme in the other direction, where you have very, very high temperatures, we can start to get some idea in terms of what are the natural fluctuations that planets go through in terms of climate change. Compare that to what's going on with Earth today, where we're actually seeing big changes in temperature over hundreds of years as opposed to the millions of years that we see on these other bodies. And that way we can get a better understanding of what's the contribution from humans versus what's the natural contribution to global change.
How much functioning technology do we have on Mars right now to help study this?
Oh, quite a bit. We have, of course, two rovers that are operating on the surface of Mars. We have the Opportunity rover, which is our little Energizer bunny, has been going and going and going since 2004. And then we also have the Curiosity rover that's been on the surface of the planet since 2012. And so they're giving us the surface perspective of what's going on, you know, in terms of, you know, atmospheric conditions, dust storms, and so forth. But we also have a number of orbiting missions at Mars. We have the Mars Odyssey mission that's been in orbit since 2001. We've got the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. We've got the MAVEN mission. We've got European Space Agency has a mission called Mars Express. India has a mission in orbit. So there's lots and lots of hardware up at Mars. And in particular, the MAVEN mission is really interesting to us in terms of the issue of climate change, because it's actually measuring how fast the Martian atmosphere is escaping today and can actually extrapolate backwards and figure out how long ago did we have a much thicker atmosphere that could support Earth-like conditions, and how fast is the atmosphere actually being lost today, and what are the processes that by which it's being lost.
We've heard that they have found evidence of liquid water on Mars. What do we know now about Mars? Just concrete, yes, we know this.
Okay, we do know that there is lots of water ice on the planet. So we have some water ice in polar caps. We have some at the higher latitudes that's right at the surface. But we also do see evidence that there are regions that actually change in appearance seasonally. They darken in the spring and the summer, and then they go away in the fall and the winter. And our, you know, from looking at it spectroscopically, where we can get the chemical information, we have determined that, yes, it does appear to be briny water that is actually seeping out onto the surface. So it does appear that we do actually have liquid water on Mars as well. Most of our models that we look at in terms of, okay, what's the surface temperature and how much heat is coming out from the inside of the planet and so forth, tell us that the liquid water reservoirs are probably on the order of about a mile or so down into the surface. But there may be areas where it's much closer to the surface. So those, of course, are interesting to us, again, for the resource aspect. But also, of course, there's this question of whether or not Mars may have ever had its own life forms. And areas where we can actually identify where there's liquid water and go and explore those in the future will definitely be of interest to us in terms of the question of whether or not life has ever existed on the planet or if it exists there today.
Well, when are we going to get there and find out?
Well, of course, we have a lot of robotic missions going on right now, and they're kind of our robotic geologists on the surface of the planet. We do have a mission that's going in 2020. Right now, it's just called Mars 2020. Not a very inventive name, but someday we'll have a better name for it. But anyway, that mission is actually going to collect samples of the surface and store them on board, and then a future mission will actually come and retrieve those and bring them back to Earth for us to analyze. In 2020, the European Space Agency also is planning to send a mission called ExoMars that's going to land on the surface and actually drill down into the near surface, down to about a yard. And our hope is that those cores that we'll get from that drilling will give us some information as to whether or not there's fossils or life forms, you know, at depth. And then in terms of humans actually going to Mars, that's always a million-dollar question, you know, and, you know, it's more than that to actually send them there. So
it's a several-billion-dollar question, yes.
It's at least a billion-dollar question. But there is a very strong push both from the private side now, from companies like SpaceX, as well as NASA, European Space Agency, the Russians, Chinese, India, you know, all the nations are really interested in this. And so there is talk about actually sending humans to Mars in the 2030 timeframe.
Sending them there seems to be not as hard as getting them back, I would
imagine. Yeah. Part of the issue with going with sending humans to Mars, I mean, you know, some of us remember when we had the Apollo missions to the moon and, okay, they go out and a few days later they come back. Well, Mars, of course, is quite a ways further away. And if we launch at a time when Earth and Mars are kind of closest together in their orbits, it still takes on the order of about 6 to 9 months to actually reach Mars. Then once you're at Mars, you know, presumably we're going to want to spend a little bit of time, at least a month exploring and so forth. But then if you hop in your spacecraft and try to come back, it's going to take you on the order for about a year and a half because Mars and Earth have actually moved apart from each other in their orbits. So that's the challenge. You know, how long do we keep the astronauts on the surface? Do we keep them on the surface for almost an entire Mars year, which is about 2 Earth years? Have them do a lot of exploring and then come back in about 6 to 9 months? Those are some of the challenges that are facing us.
Okay, the question everybody wants to know. How accurate was the movie The Martian?
It was actually quite good. There are, of course, a few things that, you know, those of us who study Mars kind of went, you know, that's Hollywood for you. But in general, it did a very good job. Probably our biggest complaint about the movie is the very first scene where you got this massive dust storm that's blowing everything over, and that's what strands them there. Spoiler alert. But but it is a case where the Martian atmosphere is so thin that even with strong winds and the dust storms we do see there, it's not entirely clear that you have enough force from that wind to actually be blowing things over in that manner. So that's kind of the major issue that we have with it. And then, of course, there's little minor things here and there. But overall, it was very well done. I mean, in terms of the scientific accuracy and, you know, possibly being able to survive by planting potatoes and, you know, in the Martian soil and adding nutrients in various ways, you know, all of that was very well done.
Dr. Nadine Barlow is a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Northern Arizona University, and she'll be back later on in the program. A new book is revealing the beauty of the universe through the lens of a powerful X-ray telescope. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Since it was launched back in 1999 aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia, NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory has provided scientists with spectacular visions of the universe that are largely hidden from telescopes that are sensitive only to visible light. Now, Dr. Wallace Tucker, a science spokesperson for the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory Chandra X-ray Center, tells the story of the orbiting space telescope's exploration in the book Chandra's Cosmos: Dark Matter, Black Holes, and Other Wonders Revealed. The book is organized into three parts: The Big, The Bad, and The Beautiful, featuring dozens of dazzling color photographs, layering images that were recorded by Chandra, and data from other path-breaking telescopes to present extraordinary new views of the cosmos. I spoke to Dr. Tucker about the book and asked where Chandra is right about now.
Chandra is, as we speak, somewhere between 6,000 and 80,000 miles above the Earth, in a highly elliptical, elongated orbit, and it's been there since 1999.
Where is it, say, in comparison to Hubble? Is it further out, closer, looking at different things?
It's much further out than Hubble. Hubble is roughly 300 miles above the Earth, and it's that way so people can service it. Chandra is much further out. It is a good thing in one sense, is that there's much less hazard of coming in and out of sunlight all the time and so forth. So that's why it was picked for this orbit. That's one of the reasons. And it looks at different things. It's really a complement to Hubble. Hubble looks at objects that are roughly 10,000 degrees, which means stars like the sun. Chandra looks at objects that are millions of degrees, which means you get an entirely different picture of the universe this way. You're seeing the hot face of the universe.
And what brought you to do this book?
Chandra has really, as I mentioned, made some profound contributions, and it's sort of not gotten as much publicity as Hubble, because Hubble's a very dramatic telescope, and I wanted people to realize that Chandra is sort of on equal footing with Hubble. If you look at the number of scientific discoveries and the number of papers written by scientists, it's they are really partners. I wouldn't say one's better than the other, but they're very important to get both views of the universe. Chandra marks the first time that an X-ray telescope has had resolution comparable to optical telescopes, because it's hard to focus X-rays. If you think about X-rays, they have such energy that if you use a normal mirror, the X-rays would just plow right into the mirror. They have to sort of skip off the edge of the mirror like you're skipping a stone off of a pond. So they have to be carefully designed with enormous precision. They're the most precisely ground mirrors ever made.
So many of the images in this book are composite images taken from Chandra and other telescopes, other sources. What do these combined images tell us that just a single view would not?
Well, I like to use the analogy of a baseball field. If you had one image, let's say you could only look down the first baseline or only look down the third baseline, you could sort of know what baseball was about, but you'd miss a lot of the game, frankly. And so this is sort of spreading over the entire baseball diamond with these, with Hubble, Spitzer is in the infrared, and Chandra is in the X-ray. So we get a more complete picture by far. And when we started making the images for the web, we did this consciously because we were one of the first ones to do this. We wanted to show what you would see if you didn't have the whole picture and what you see with the whole picture. You see different temperature of stars, different temperature of matter, different things going on.
You talk about how this has given us a better idea. Well, I'll ask you, has this given us a better idea of what dark matter is?
It's enabled us to give us a better idea of how dark matter is distributed in the universe. We still don't know what dark matter is, and that's a profound puzzle.
I was hoping to get answers today. I really was.
Sorry about that. But we were able to show, for example, in one object called the Bullet Cluster of Galaxies, that dark matter and normal matter are separated when two huge gas clouds collide. You can literally see the normal matter dragging behind and the dark matter just glides through. And this gives us some very strict restrictions on the nature of dark matter. In other words, how does it interact or collide with normal matter? And so far, best we can say, it doesn't do it at all. And that limits the possible explanations.
So the big, the bad, the beautiful, that's how you separate all these. How did you figure out which went into which?
Well, I just sort of sorted them. I got to thinking about it. If you know, I spend quite a bit of time talking to people about the results of Chandra, and I got a feeling for the questions they answered, and they sort of fell into these categories. The big is the big universe as a whole, the biggest scales you can think of. The bad is, of course, the black holes. They're scary. They pull matter in, but never gets out again. And then the beautiful, well, that's us in terms of how are we made. We're made of elements that come from the stars, really. And all of these elements that we're made of, most of them anyway, are forged inside of stars. And so the beautiful was relating to this process by which stars build up elements such as carbon and oxygen and iron, and then they're expelled from the stars in supernova explosions. And eventually, given a few billion years, there becomes a beautiful planet, and people such as us maybe evolve. At least they did on this planet.
I certainly don't want to give people the impression that this is just a picture book. There's an awful lot of great information in this book. It's a great read.
Well, thank you.
But I will talk about a picture right now. some of them, you just sit there and you can stare at them for 5, 6, 7 minutes and just take it all in. There is one that really, just, I couldn't take my eyes off of, the tidal disruptor picture. That's just an amazing image.
It's a star being torn apart, right? Is that what it is?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is one of the things that's happened. It's not simply due to Chandra, but it's certainly Chandra's played an important role. If a star comes too close to a black hole, in, say, in the center of a galaxy, the force, it's like a tidal force. The force on one side of the star is much greater, namely the star side next to the black hole, than it is on the far side. And so the force of gravity is so strong, it literally overwhelms the gravity of the star and pulls the star apart. And some of these images, and some of them are illustrations, they show the matter of the star really being pulled apart and the material sucked into the black hole, at least some of it.
So what is the lifespan of Chandra? How long will it be up there?
We don't know. When it was first proposed, NASA conservatively said it'll last 5 years. And that would have been gone out of business in 2004, 2005. So it's well beyond its lifespan. But they do tests continually on the performance of Chandra. They have equipment that's in orbit, and they have similar equipment back on Earth, and they sort of monitor how these things perform. And they say there's nothing to limit it from going another 10 years. And as you're probably aware, space is not a totally safe place. Something could hit it. It's not likely, but something could happen. But right now, everybody's planning and hoping it'll last another 5 to 10 years.
Is Chandra 2 on the drawing board someplace?
That has been a problem. There is one. It's pretty far out. I think it's maybe 10 years in the future. They did such a good job with Chandra. They're trying to come up with the next best Chandra has proved quite a challenge. And there's a lot of competition for those research dollars. And they are now working, I think, towards several possible follow-ons. And they I don't know if they've decided yet. I think they have one that's called Linux right now. And don't ask me to explain what those numbers, that acronym means. But that's probably it, and it probably will be another 10 years before we see it in orbit.
Are these programs, are they privately funded? Are they government funded? Is there a chance they may be cut one of these days?
They are government funded, and there's always a chance that they can be cut, yes. We have to make a presentation. Every 2 years, we make a big presentation to the NASA officials as to what Chandra has done. And it's reviewed by an independent panel of scientists, and they make recommendations. Well, maybe you should look at this, or maybe you should take these precautions, or maybe everything's going just fine. So far, they've said it. Maybe it's going just fine. Maybe you can cut back here in terms of support personnel. But more or less, we've gotten high grades every review.
Again, the name of Dr. Wallace Tucker's new book is Chandra's Cosmos, Dark Matter, Black Holes, and Other Wonders Revealed. It's published by Smithsonian Books. So since we started the show by talking about Mars, let's go way back in the archives for an Academic Minute recorded by Dr. Nadine Barlow in 2013.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella. Volcanic eruptions and nuclear tests are among the most powerful explosions that take place on Earth. Nadine Barlow, professor of physics and astronomy at Northern Arizona University, explains how such terrestrial events provide a key for understanding the nature of otherworldly impacts.
An asteroid hurtles from space and strikes the Martian surface, creating an impact crater. The hit causes a turbulent dust cloud to flow outward, scattering a thin layer of fine-grained material that settles up to 20 times the crater's radius. Winds normally remove this deposit within a few weeks of its formation, but in certain areas of the planet, the deposits somehow resist erosion and survive for millions of years. What's the secret behind their longevity? Our survey of Mars has revealed 140 craters with these unusually thin and widespread deposits. They are associated with small craters found in thick, fine-grained sedimentary deposits, most of which are found in the ice-rich mid to high latitudes. Based on similar deposits on Earth that are formed around explosive volcanoes and nuclear explosions, it is likely they form when material ejected from the crater strikes the surrounding fine-grained deposits, kicking those small particles up into the turbulent atmospheric flow. The resulting dust cloud rolls along the surface, eventually settling around the crater. All impact craters on Mars probably form this type of deposit, and normally it is quickly removed by winds. But those that remain resist erosion due to a thin, salt-rich crust that is formed when water that reaches the surface of the deposit evaporates, leaving the salt layer behind. It's similar to the process we see in dry lake beds in the desert southwest. This salty crust protects the deposit from immediate erosion, making it visible to us even millions of years later. Today, Mars is cold and dry, but the fine-grained, ice-rich sediments tell us that the planet undergoes major climate variations over the span of a few million years. When conditions are right, snow and dust can blanket the mid-latitudes, giving rise to the conditions that create and preserve these types of layered deposits.
That was Nadine Barlow of Northern Arizona University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org.
I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.